Welcome to the Shaping Portsmouth podcast. Shaping Portsmouth is a collaboration of key Portsmouth businesses, transforming Portsmouth together. Hello, and welcome to another Shaping Portsmouth podcast with me, CEO Dave Humphreys. And today I am joined by former Olympic swimmer, Katie Sexton. Hello, Katie.
Hello, welcome. Dave. Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming to join us. So you had your first encounter of Shaping Portsmouth last week at our conference.
Yep.
So it's great to get you in so quickly to do a podcast. But how did you find the conference?
Oh, it was amazing. I think I've heard lots of things. I've heard lots of things about a lot of the people that were there and the awards that were given out to the different people in the community. And to actually put the faces to people was just really nice. And, well, what a way to start the year, really.
Yeah. So, was it what you were expecting? Because obviously we'd met and spoken about Shaping Portsmouth. Did you have any idea what you were getting into?
I think it was probably one of them things where you just go in with an open mind and everything's a bonus. And I came away, kind of took a few days to digest the whole event, really, because there was so much good stuff happening and so many great people to actually meet.
Mm, definitely, definitely. I think it took us a few days to digest it as well. So people will know you perhaps from your swimming days.
Absolutely.
So you've got two world championship medals, a gold and a silver.
Yep.
And you swam in two Olympics.
Yes.
Is that right? Was it two or three?
Yeah, two. I swam in Sydney and in Athens.
Right. So are we looking at 2004 and 2008?
2004 and 2000.
2000,
yeah.
So earlier than I was thinking. So,
yeah,
how time flies.
I know.
So let's start at the beginning then. So how did you get involved in swimming in the first place?
A simple thing being, grew up in Portsmouth, not far from Baffin's Pond, got an older sister, mum and dad, you are going to swim. That is the one thing you have to be able to do. We live by the sea and it was just that pure safety aspect. So they put me into swimming lessons. I joined Portsmouth North Sea when I think I was six and just worked myself through the club. Loved swimming, loved every aspect about it. I never thought I'd get to the heights I got to when I started. And it's just been amazing that my hobby and the thing that I love doing became my job.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, how old were you when you sort of first started swimming at that elite level, sort of Olympic world championship level?
I think it was probably, I was 13, I had my first GB call up, which was for the Youth Olympics. Mm-hmm. So it, I mean, back then we were lucky enough that it was in Bath.
Right.
So the fortunate thing with that was it was a home Olympics. You got to do the opening ceremony, parade through the streets of Bath. And at 13 years old, that was a phenomenal memory to have. And obviously it made it accessible for my parents and my family to come and watch. Mm. So, I mean, now they could be anywhere in the world and you have that deficit then of your family support. And that means everything to me because they're the ones that get you to training. They're the ones that support you through the hard times. Everyone knows swimming's renowned for stupid times in the morning, before school, after school and all that stuff. And I wouldn't have been able to do that without my mum.
Yeah. And I suppose at that age, how much of an impact did training at that level have on your life? I mean, it must have been pretty full on.
Oh, completely. And I look back now and I'm not quite sure how I managed to do it all. I think I was permanently tired. I think, if anything, training then prepared me for parenthood.
Right.
Because you're permanently tired as a mum and I was permanently tired then. But, I mean, it was tough. Especially at this time of year, it's dark in the morning.
Yeah.
No one wants to get out of bed at 5 o'clock and go and swim for 2 hours in the pool. I think one of my teachers used to call me and my friend. He used to say it smelled like a chemist at the back of his class because we'd both be there together smelling of chlorine. I had my head on the desk quite a few times in school because I was tired. But swimming definitely taught me how to be organised. It taught me to be respectful to sort of older peers and things like that, because there's always like a rank and a pecking order and discipline. I think they're the key things that I have definitely learned from sport, and obviously they're just transferable into other aspects of life.
So especially at that sort of age, what What really motivated you to keep doing that, you know, for 2 hours every morning at 5 a.m.? Are you naturally competitive, or
yes.
Is it love of swimming? Or
I think it's a combination. I think we always used to, at the start of the year, you'd sit down with your coach and you'd write out your goals and your targets and what do you want to get out of the year. Or we'd always, when it kind of, you got older, you'd always work to a 4-year plan because the Olympic cycle's every 4 years.
Yeah, of course.
So you'd kind of have that in place. And actually what we targeted this year to help us next year and so on and so forth. So I think those goals always helped motivate me. I had posters on my wall of like Olympic type logos and things like that. And watching the Olympic Games in itself, you see other people achieving things and you think, yeah, I want a bit of that. So you'd always have those things that would keep you going. I think a lot of self-determination to do stuff. I think I can be quite stubborn. So if someone tells me I can't do it, I'd be like, well, I'm going to prove you wrong. So there's always that motivation as well.
And how, I mean, what's it actually like going to an Olympics? What's the feeling like when you, because you must obviously walk out with the team in that opening ceremony. What are those really special moments? I mean, there must be.
Oh, 100%. I mean, you can't ever compare it to anything else. With the Olympics, you don't normally get to go to the opening ceremony if you're competing on the first, say, 5 days of the program, because it's such a long evening.
Swimming's always right at the start.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Swimming starts it off. So for us, we're normally swimming on day 2 or 3 of the event. Yeah. So you have to sit at home and watch it on the TV. But the best bit about an opening ceremony is walking into the arena.
Yeah.
That is by far, that is the most mind-blowing thing, because I can't describe it enough. It just completely sits with you forever. There's a lot of hanging around. You obviously don't get to see a lot of the stuff because you're waiting in a parade to go in your team order. So just that initial bit when you walk out, though, is, wow.
And I suppose you would have been swimming competitively for Portsmouth North Sea as your club. And then obviously the Team GB obviously pluck out the people who are in the Olympic team. Do you have different coaches then with the Team GB for the Olympics than you would with Portsmouth North Sea?
Yes, kind of you do. I think I was very fortunate that back in the day, the group that I swam with, there was 5 of us that went to the Olympics.
Right.
So our coach was selected, and I think he was head women's coach at one point as well. So if we were on any teams, we had that luxury that he was there with us.
Okay.
And quite often it would be done on, they have this ranking system where the top time or the most amount of points is like a world record time, and then it goes down from that. So depending on which athlete had the highest world ranking time would necessarily depend which coaches were invited. Right. Because obviously, if you're picked as a higher ranked athlete, you want to have as much home normal support around you as possible.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, yeah.
So did that mean you got to take your own coach with you then?
Yeah, we were very fortunate in that.
Yeah. Because did you break a world record?
No.
No.
No, I've got Commonwealth records lots of British records.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And so the, being part of that whole Team GB piece, how much are you aware of what's going on across the whole team and what other people are doing, and that sense of a team feeling, and how much of it is you in your own little bubble focused on your event? And
I think you're in your whole little bubble as soon as you enter the Olympic Village, to be quite honest, Dave, because you're just with all these other elite sports people.
Yeah.
I mean, a memory that stands out for me is we were in Sydney and we were in the dining hall. Now, the dining hall, think 4 football pitches back to back with food everywhere from across the world, including a McDonald's. Everyone always asks, is there a McDonald's in the village? Yes, there is.
Yeah.
And you just have your accreditation around your neck. You can go in certain places and it's almost like a free pass to life. We sat down in the dining hall one day and Muhammad Ali walks in. So it's just like, exactly. Yeah. But you're like, oh my goodness, how, like, it's a proper pinchy moment, because you could just walk down the street and you'd see Usain Bolt, or you'd see Linford Christie or Sally Gunner, or, you know, all these names of old and stuff like that. I mean, one of my idols growing up was Sir Steve Redgrave.
Yeah.
So being in the village with him in Sydney was amazing.
Yeah.
You know, it's a it's a proper pinch me moment. And yeah, you're totally in awe of all these people.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Everybody there is after the same thing. Everybody's really supportive of kind of like what the end goal is.
Yeah.
So it's a very nice sort of, again, community feel. But it's a different community feel.
Yeah, I think
the hard bit is when you leave that and you go home and you're kind of like left to your own devices.
Yeah. And I take it because of your age, you have family support there with you as well. Or are you taken out and looked after solely by the team?
You are literally in the team.
Right.
That's it. So from, I think I was 15 when I had my first senior GB call up, we whisked off to Perth in Australia. So I sort of explaining to my school, no, it's not Perth, Scotland, it's Perth, Australia. I need to be away for sort of 4 weeks. And obviously being in year 11, it was quite a prominent year of schooling.
Yeah.
But they were very supportive of that back then. So you just kind of left to get on with it. You grow up quite quickly.
And I suppose some sports, say tennis, for example, you hear people like Roger Federer talking about, you know, the minute you've played the point, that point's done. And you need to forget about it and focus on the next point. But for things like swimming, where it's that race, that's probably a bit different. And how self-critical do you become about your own performance? Do you find yourself looking back on stuff, getting angry with yourself?
Oh, totally. Totally. I mean, I think it's always one of them things. We're very fortunate because we'd spend a lot of time with the divers, because obviously aquatic disciplines together. Theirs is always judged by somebody. Ours was on time.
Yep.
So the clock doesn't lie. You don't have any of that political voting or anything going on. So they were always like, you're so lucky. You're against the clock. So I think ultimately we used to have a heat, a semi-final and a final. And it used to be, I don't know, say there were 30 people in the heats. The top 16 would get through to the semi-finals. And then the top 8 would get through to the finals. So after each round, it was almost like, right, well, that round's done.
Yep.
It doesn't really matter where you are in that 16, you're in the next round. Yep. And then can we get that to the top 8? And then whatever happens in the final happens.
And how is it when you have the special moments? You know, how do you feel when you finish a race and you've broken a British record?
Well, that's a cloud 9 feeling.
Yeah.
But I think it's something...
That was a stupid question,
it's
really.
It's not really. It's not, because
it's...
I said this before to somebody. You practice what you do all the time, but you don't ever practice how to stand on a rostrum, how to receive a medal. You don't practice those things because although you want them, and that is what you're striving to do, when it actually comes to it, you're standing there going, what do I do? Because I didn't actually prep for this bit.
Yeah.
It's what I wanted, but I didn't practice this bit.
Yeah.
So you're standing on the rostrum going, do I sing the national anthem? Do I, is everybody, everybody's looking at me. I know everybody's looking at me, but I just wish our national anthem was longer.
Really?
Yeah, you're never up there for long enough.
Yeah, I suppose no matter how long you're there, it would be one of those moments that would feel like it was over in a blink.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, that must have been absolutely incredible to be stood there and receive a gold medal.
Yeah. I mean, things have changed a lot now. Like the Paris Olympics, for example, you are very close to the arena. You're very kind of involved in what's actually happening, and the athletes get out and you can go and speak to your family and see them and all that kind of stuff. Like, we didn't get that back then. And obviously things like social media have helped raise the profile of a lot of athletes.
Yeah, yeah, of
course. And if we're talking 20 years ago, like, none of that existed.
Yeah, yeah. The... Yeah, I suppose that whole level of access to people and communication must change it quite dramatically. But daft question. I'm sure you get asked this a lot, but what do you do with your medal afterwards? Is it like just tucked in a drawer? Have you got it framed on a wall? I know you brought it to the conference, but...
Yeah, most of them just sit in the bottom of the wardrobe.
Really?
Yeah, they come out on special occasions, sort of like last week or if I go and do school visits and things like that, I'll always take them. But my world championship medals, Barcelona is where I won them. Barcelona's quirky. The medals are quirky. They've got a bit of glass in the middle with like fluid inside it.
Wow.
So I'd been presented my medal and I looked down and I was like, I've cracked it. How have I cracked the glass? It's only been around my neck. I am quite clumsy, so it wouldn't have surprised me if I'd managed to do something. But then I picked it up and looked at it and the fluid, you saw the fluid actually move in. Mm. So I was like, it's really cool. But obviously they're so fragile to hand out, whereas the other ones, it doesn't matter. They are obviously priceless to me, but I don't mind people touching them in the same way.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So as an elite athlete, how do you deal with the end of your competitive career? I've spoken before to sort of people that have been linked with footballers that have had career-ending injuries and their careers have sort of come to an abrupt end. But there's obviously a point where you think to yourself, I can't compete at this level anymore. Does that not have an impact on you as an individual, your kind of sense of being, your mental health, perhaps?
Oh, 100%. I think it's just trying to find your identity. I think that's the hardest part. It's like I'm always known as Katie the swimmer. So then actually, when you take yourself out, it's like, what am I good at? What can I do? I don't have any experience in like the workforce per se. Obviously, I've got a lot of experience that is transferable, but it's very, very hard to then kind of detrain yourself from that.
Yeah, and especially, I suppose, if you're really used to that training regime and it's become a way of life, stopping doing that must be quite difficult.
Yeah, very, very difficult. I think I went through probably, from my own personal experience, I probably went through a little bit of, well, I fell out of love with the sport.
Right.
So the not training thing was, I was finding excuses not to go. So it's like, right, I now know the time is right to kind of knock it on the head.
Mm. So that probably helped you, did it?
Yes and no, but I think then it goes back to the mental health side of things because you just feel lost. You don't have a purpose. And you've got to find that purpose. And when you've just done the same thing for 15 years, what do you do?
I can relate to that a bit. 30 years in policing and you feel really institutionalised.
Absolutely.
So retirement's actually quite scary. But I'm thinking, all of that in the world of sport happens much earlier in people's lives, so it must be really quite difficult to navigate.
Yeah, I mean, I think I had my first real job age 30 because I was just kind of like, well, what do I do? I don't know, just bimbling through life really.
So what did you do? What's your career look like post swimming?
I went back to my secondary school. I was like, is there any opportunities? And there actually happened to be something that popped up. So I think within about a week, I'd started working as a teaching assistant.
Right.
So I found a bit of purpose.
Yeah, quite a switch. And
because I left school at 16 because college wouldn't support my need to training because we were here for 3 weeks, then we were on a training camp for 3 weeks. So it was really hard to facilitate that. So I just took a 2-year break after school and I used to go in with my mum and help her in her classes. She had some little nurture groups with junior school. So I'd go and support her with that. So from 16, I always had that kind of experience of being in a school and it gave me that regimented time that I was used to and I could still do my training either side of the end of the start of the day and the end of the day.
Yeah, yeah. And I suppose the transferable skills in terms of swimming coaching and stuff like that are obviously obvious.
Yeah.
You've clearly found yourself being pulled back into that. Was that a moment where, like you said, you fell out of love with the sport? Was that a moment where you kind of fell back in love with it, but in a different way by helping others?
I think so. I mean, I set up my own swim academy back in 2010, but I just found myself running a business that I didn't know what on earth I was doing. And I just felt like I was just bumbling my way through it.
Mm.
But that was me trying to give a little bit back to the community because they'd supported me through my career, and learning to swim is an important life skill.
And obviously for people like North Sea, you're quite high profile in terms of success. Have you stayed linked with the club and still doing stuff with them? And
I did do some master's coaching. So master's in swimming is anybody aged 18 and above.
Right.
So I have tried a little bit of master's competition myself. But I just find the expectation people have on me is too much.
Yeah.
I'm there to enjoy it. It's not serious for me. I just want to swim and relive the stuff that I missed because you're so serious when you're focused on your career. So actually doing the master swimming for myself was just trying to, I don't know, get a little bit of love back and a bit of fun element for me. But like I say, the expectation of people, well, you didn't win that, that wasn't very good. And it's like, I'm not here for that. I'm just here for the fun purpose. So I did end up coaching their master's group for a couple of years.
That makes sense, and I can totally see it. And I suppose if you're someone else, why wouldn't you want to be?
Well, yeah,
Katie Sexton, the Olympic swimmer. You know, it would. It must be quite frustrating that, that you can't be allowed to enjoy it in the
way. Well, I'd always try
to,
and swim like a breaststroke event or a butterfly event because that's not what I competed in. So the element of expectation was less.
Yeah, makes sense. Makes sense. But now you're doing something completely different.
Yeah.
In terms of your new venture, Goggleheads.
Absolutely.
So tell us about Goggleheads. What is it, first of all?
So the Goggleheads are water safety characters.
Yeah.
And it was one of those ideas that started through COVID when we couldn't get in the swimming pools. We just wanted, myself and one of my swimming teachers, we were like, how can we keep the kids aware of all the safety and the dangers of swimming, because everybody was accessing water outside but we couldn't get in any of the leisure centres or the swimming pools. So we kind of came up with a couple of silly characters and some like worksheets that we could just send out to parents, just highlighting some of the dangers and the risks that were still out there. And then the idea kind of snowballed and snowballed again, and we've written some stories all about water safety. And the fun characters are all part of that.
So clearly you're targeting children directly. And obviously, I suppose from a Portsmouth perspective, it makes a lot of sense because we're completely surrounded by water.
Absolutely.
You can't get away from it.
I mean, let's be honest, the whole of the UK is an island.
Yeah.
You've got the canals and everything in the Midlands. My sister's just moved up to Cumbria. You've got all the lakes up there. Each body of water's got its own risk.
And I suppose that's the point. Right at the heart of this is the risk.
Absolutely.
And I suppose there's an argument that, that every drowning is probably a preventable death.
Yes.
And I must admit, I don't know what drowning statistics in the UK look like. But I suppose it wouldn't surprise me if it's sort of weighted towards children and younger people.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think a lot of parents forget water safety starts at home, in the bath.
Yeah.
You know, it's as simple as that. It takes a glass of water to drown in. It's not a lot. And I think that's where the facts get really scary.
So, I mean, obviously, you've got a connection with water and swimming, and there's the home turf. But what are you motivated in the same way with this as you kind of would be as a competitive swimmer? I'm suspecting that it's kind of a trait that's just there in you.
I think I'm very passionate about this. I mean, the biggest fact that really bugs me is a lot of the kids I teach them into, they leave primary school, they can't swim 25 metres.
Right.
And if they can swim 25 metres, it's not enough. 25 metres is nothing. It needs to be 50 metres. It needs to be 100 metres. And the number of parents go, oh, they can swim 25 metres, we're going to stop lessons. Please don't do that. You know, you need to make sure that they can actually get themselves to safety. Because if it's 25 metres, it's probably more like 10.
Yeah.
And the definition of swimming is moving through water. It's not swimming a stroke.
Yeah.
It's it's just moving through water. So how safely and strongly can they do that? Throw in the element of panic, you know, you've cut that in half straight away as well.
Yeah, yeah, sure, sure. So in terms of getting the message out there and what you're doing with it, are you targeting schools? Are you just targeting the general population? Is there a plan to sort of publish and sell the books? What's...
Yeah, the books are on our website at the moment. Right. We've got a few more in the pipeline. Mm-hmm. It's just a slower process and I completely get writer's block now. It's nice to add author to my kind of repertoire of skills as well. That was not something I thought I'd be able to do. But predominantly we're targeting schools. We're going into a lot of the primary schools in the area, just kind of trying to raise that awareness. The biggest thing we're up against is schools are like, yes, come in the summer term. But water is a year-round hazard. Yeah. There's so many different hazards in the winter, in the summer. Yes, I know people are more accessible to water in the summer, but frozen lakes, frozen ponds, storms, all of that kind of stuff.
The risks change.
Yeah, completely.
Yeah, they never go. They're just different.
Exactly. And it's just trying to make that awareness. So we kind of want to educate the kids to educate the parents, a bit like Jamie Oliver tried to do with the school dinners.
Yeah.
So if you're out on your paddleboard, mummy, you need a life jacket on. I'm all right, I can swim. No, you need a life jacket on. You've put one on me, you need to wear one.
Yeah.
Simple things like that.
Yeah. And the one thing kids are good at is educating their parents.
Absolutely. I know that all too well.
So now obviously you're not doing this alone. So, but are you writing the stories?
I'm writing the stories. Yeah. And I've got Ollie, who is my illustrator, swimming teacher as well. He draws all the characters.
Yeah. So Ollie's background swimming as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
So nice. You've come from the same direction.
Absolutely.
And I suppose as a new venture, then what's the goal? Where are you hoping to get with it?
I would like all the schools in the UK to know about the Goggleheads in the next 5 years. You know, we'll kind of want to get them out there, get that profile raised of water safety. And it's just trying to do it in a fun, character-led way. So you're watching something. I mean, we watch a lot of Bluey in our household. I find myself watching that on my own. Yeah. I want the parents to be watching it. I want the parents to enjoy the books as much as the kids do and just take those messages on.
Yeah, that's one of the most horrific moments in parenting is when you realise that your child has stopped watching the programme that you're still avidly watching.
Yeah.
makes sense. And it's quite a goal and it's great stuff. How easy do you find the authoring side of it, coming up with the stories?
Coming up with the stories is the easy part because there's so many different things you can write around.
Yeah.
I just can waffle sometimes. So it's just trying to make sure that it's still child friendly and there's not too much waffling in there about, you know, talking for the sake of filling a page. It's been a learning curve, but a fun one. And it's nice to have a new challenge.
Mm. So if people want to access Goggleheads, how do they go about doing that?
They can contact us on our website, which is goggleheads.com.
Yep.
Someone will pick up a message and the books are on there. We have a few other bits on there as well, sort of some swimming hats for the parent that likes to swim in the sea. A nice visual hat for you to wear.
Yeah.
So they're all on our website.
Goggleheads merch.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, and that's Goggleheads and to be fair, I don't think you're going to have too much trouble finding it through a Google search engine actually, but it's all one word and heads as H-E-D-Z.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
So slightly different spelling, but but it's very distinctive. You won't miss it. You'll know when you found it. Definitely.
Absolutely.
You said, you know, you've got further plans, further stories, so you can see it growing and more marketing of the books or?
Yeah, I think it's one of those things. I mean, we have been going for sort of almost 4 or 5 years. But you learn a lot in that time, and everything changes and your initial idea that changes as well. So, we're looking to get into some like home ed groups and stuff as well because, you know, everybody needs water safety.
Yeah, totally. And alongside that, you're still involved in teaching swimming.
I am.
Do you still swim at all competitively? Sneak back into it?
No.
No.
I do look at it sometimes and go, oh, shall I? But I don't know.
But I suppose...
It's a blank page. We'll leave it at that, I think, for now.
As a parent now, do you find yourself trying to encourage your... So you have a daughter.
Yeah.
Do you encourage her to swim? Do you want to see her going down the competitive route, or would you try and keep her away from it?
I don't know. Like I say, things have changed so much from when I used to do it. She can swim. She loves swimming. It's the only thing she wants to do. And she's very competitive. Well, I have no idea where she gets it from.
I was going to say, well, I wonder where that comes from.
We were watching her on Halloween trick-or-treating and she had to bustle past all her friends. She had to be first at every house. So it's quite funny to watch her. Yeah. She's got that natural competitive streak. Whatever sport she does, she will do a sport for definite.
Yeah.
But yeah, swimming's non-negotiable. Mm. She needs to learn to swim. Yep. Whether she follows in my footsteps, that's entirely her choice. There'll be no pressure there from me.
No. And I suppose, you know, obviously as a parent yourself, and you mentioned the sort of family support in the early days and how important that was, them getting you to training, et cetera, and everything that goes with it. But who were the sort of inspirational people around you at that point that really made a difference to you at that level?
I think I was very, very fortunate. My coach was very inspirational. He was very focused. He was very driven himself. Mm. And I think there were points I probably saw him more than my dad because of my dad's job. So he'd be the main kind of like father figure that I would see day in, day out. And his daughter used to swim in the squad with us.
Right.
So he was very inspirational to me. And actually the team I used to swim with, we were probably a mixed age, sort of like an age range of 4 to 5 years. Mm. The older ones always looked after you.
Right.
You always felt very supported with them. And yeah, it was just a really nice team ethos that we used to have. And everybody kind of looked after each other and you kind of, you know, you wouldn't go home without everybody, just making sure everybody was okay and always checking in with people. And I think that little real team feel, even though swimming is very much an individual sport, that team ethos was really, really supportive.
Yeah. I've sort of been involved younger in different sports, but swimming was one of my big ones as a youngster. And I can relate to that because it's the people you encourage each other.
Yeah.
It's important to have people around you that are supportive. Did you find that was different at club level to national level? Did you find that there was a stronger club bond or because you saw them more or at national level, is it easy to sort of, you know, you see the same people again and pick that up?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, I think, again, the group we used to swim with, there was a lot of elitism in our squad. Mm. So if we did go to a national competition, you'd have a lot of familiar faces there. So I don't know. At the end of the day, whatever team you're with, you get into that mode and you support each other.
Yeah.
And it's just that really nice vibe that you have.
Definitely. Well, yeah, I mean, Goggleheads is an amazing thing. They're great characters. I love the books. And we will certainly add links and stuff in with the podcast. So if people want to go and have a look, they can. And, you know, I'm sure we'll be doing some more stuff with you to try and support this because it's important. And
it's
something we want to promote within the community from a Shaping Portsmouth perspective. You know, and especially with, you know, the amazing waterfront that we've got in the city, you know, with the great job that's being done all around the city with the seafront works and stuff.
Sure.
But, you know, as we alluded to, you're a Portsmouth girl.
Absolutely.
And we always like to finish our podcast with a little bit of a focus back on the city and asking our guests to make a recommendation of somewhere to go or something to do in Portsmouth. What would be yours?
I think I would have to recommend doing a dockyard tour on the boat, like the harbour tour. I've done it a few times myself.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I think the first time we did it, we were fortunate enough that the new aircraft carriers were in. did it in the summer, and they weren't.
Yeah.
So it swings and roundabouts with what you get. But, I mean, the people on the boat, the commentary that you get is phenomenal. And I think every time I go, I learn something new about Portsmouth. So, yeah, it's great.
It is brilliant, isn't it? So we run the, as you would have seen at the conference on Friday, we run the cruise passenger meet and greet program up at the port. And for some of the ships, they lay that on as a water taxi. So you get off the ferry, you get off your cruise and you get that down to Gunwharf.
Oh, amazing.
And they get all the commentary, the feedback we get from that and how much the tourists love it is incredible. But if anyone's listening and hasn't done that, You can just go into the historic dockyard by the main gate and you can get a ticket to go on that tour. If you've got an annual pass for the whole of the historic quarter, which covers Victory, the National Museum of the Royal Navy, and also the Mary Rose, then that boat is included in the annual pass. You can do it as many times as you like.
Yeah.
And you are right. It's so worth doing.
Yeah.
It's so worth doing. It's funny because actually that's not what I was expecting you to recommend.
Do I want to know what you were?
So the first time we met was in a little cafe up behind Hillsey Line. So I wondered if that's what your recommendation was going to be.
What, a bit of wakeboarding?
up there. And just up at that little cafe, it's just like a good little spot. Although we probably picked the worst day.
Yeah, memorable meeting for sure.
to sit out there with like hurricane level gales.
Yeah.
But that's a great spot up there. And I suppose,
can't wait for the Lido to be open.
What I was going to say is, really, as a swimmer, you must be really excited about what they're doing up
there. Yeah, 100%.
It must be great. And that helps add into that encouraging children to get in the water, learn to swim.
Definitely.
By making things like that accessible.
I mean, I'm of an era where my parents were Pompeians as well, and that used to be where they go. So the fact that now it will be a nice place for everybody to go, I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah. And of course, the work, because we mentioned the seafront works going on around the city, that includes the northern end, and the stuff that's going on up there. I know Fairways have got a whole project around that side with the where the cafe is, around the Phoenix Project and the wood carvings that they're going to put in. And of course, that'd be another fellow swimming and Olympian colleague of yours, Laura Steadman, who's supporting that work.
Amazing.
With the amazing team at Fairways. But that just adds weight to the arm of the Goggleheads, and the fact that there are all of these amazing parks surrounded by water, places that you can go in Portsmouth with your children. So make sure that they are water safe.
Yeah, safety first.
Definitely. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for coming along to the conference and coming on stage with us and actually bringing your medal to the conference as well. I know I saw a few pictures on social media of people meeting you. But no, thank you. Thank you so much. It's been great chatting to you. And I'm sure we'll see you again soon.
Yeah, thank you very much.
This podcast was brought to you by Shaping Portsmouth, working to make Portsmouth the number one UK city in which to invest, live, learn, work and visit. To find out more, please visit shapingportsmouth.co.uk. This podcast was supported by Spark Community Space and Portsmouth Community Lottery.